Here are some American voices speaking about freedom of religion.
Well, currently there's a lot of tension in America over religion. It's similar to when the Irish came here and they had tension with the Protestants, and now it's the Muslims having tension with the Christians. But I think these things will be overcome over time.
It's important for people to be able to have religious freedom because everybody has a different higher being. And I know who I believe in, and I think everybody should be able to believe in who they want to believe in.
Free thinking is important to me, and that the ability to worship or think in the ways that are best suited for your life and experience are important to me. The U.S. believes that it is special in its religious freedoms. Whether it actually is exercising a tolerance of diverse religions is something that it continues to try to work on.
You know, people should just be free to just, you know, think, you know, believe what they want.
Because I'm against religion, so I want to be, I'm, in fact, there's a, have you heard of the Freedom From Religion Foundation? Yeah, I'm kind of like with them.
I value religious freedom. As a Buddhist, I believe everyone should has the right to believe whatever they want to believe without any kind of reaction from the community or the government.
I don't want people making me practice their particular religion, and I would rather just be able to investigate any religion I'm curious about or have no religion at all if I want.
I don't really pay much attention to it. I just think that you should be able to believe in whatever you believe in.
I think that basically most people in this country don't value religious freedom because they take it for granted. They don't come from countries like in Eastern Europe where you've been forbade to practice religion. So I think looking at it from that perspective, I think it's hard for an American to appreciate religious freedom because we get it so easily.
I think it gives a person a chance to express himself in a free country.
And freedom of your thoughts in spiritual matters, as all other matters, is a foundation for kind of a democratic society. I have to think that there is still some uniqueness to the American experience that clearly, historically, has valued freedom.
Welcome to Religion and the Constitution. This is a series of conversations about the law and what freedom of religion actually means in the United States. My name is Jerry Dunkley. In this segment of our series on religious freedom under the First Amendment, we're going to talk about two laws, one passed in 1993, another in 2000, that have had a significant impact on the free exercise of religion in the United States. The first is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, signed in 1993. The second is the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, passed in 2000. Why were they passed when it would seem the First Amendment would do the legal job here? The idea today is to try to answer some of these questions. Let me say at the outset that these laws and their application are controversial, and people disagree about various aspects of them. Our guest is Carla Chafee. She is an attorney with Robinson & Cole in Boston. She specializes in these two laws and, of course, the First Amendment. Welcome to our podcast. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you, Jerry. I'm happy to be here.
One of the issues that I'd like you to start with is, why was the Religious Freedom Restoration Act passed by Congress in the first place? Why did they think there was a need for a special law when we have a First Amendment in place?
Well, Jerry, that really comes back to Supreme Court precedent and a Supreme Court case called Employment Division v. Smith. That was a case that many, including Congress and the individuals behind RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, believed that the court kind of took a step back from prior Supreme Court precedents. And the holding of that case, in simplified terms, really was that if a law is neutral of general applicability, then that law itself cannot burden religious exercise. This was often referred to as the peyote case, where two individuals were denied unemployment benefits after being dismissed from their their jobs based on the use of peyote in a religious ceremony. So in the backlash of that case, Congress acted to pass RFRA.
I suppose many of us would be a little confused about how a case involving a Native American tribe's use of peyote ended up concerning the Congress and other religious people in the United States. Can you describe that a little bit more?
Sure. So there was a line of cases under the First Amendment before this Employment Division v. Smith case.
Attorney Chafee described an earlier case called Sherbert v. Verner from 1963.
And in that case, a woman was denied unemployment benefits based on her refusal to work on Saturday, her Sabbath. In that case, the court had held there was an individualized assessment made by the unemployment board in this case. And since they made that individualized assessment and evaluated that she should lose her unemployment benefits because she had just simply chosen not to work, she should not qualify. The court said, that is not the type of decision we want our government entities to be making. If the reason for her choosing not to work on a Saturday is based in her religious faith, then she should have a right to do so, and the government should not impose a substantial burden on her that makes her choose between following her religious precepts on one hand and receiving a governmental benefit on the other. And then along came the Smith case five to six years later. I'm not exactly sure on the date. And many view the facts of this case as very similar. An opinion by Justice Scalia, he made a very probably sweeping statement in saying, well, if a law is not designed to target religion, it's really just a neutral law, and it seems to end up having an incidental impact on religious exercise. In this case, the neutral law being, well, if you're dismissed from your employment based on drug use, you cannot receive unemployment benefits. Okay, so since that law is neutral and is not aimed at religion, then it is okay for the government to apply that neutral law in a completely neutral way, even though there might be an incidental burden to religion. So, again, many saw this as moving away from how the court had interpreted the First Amendment and religious protections under the First Amendment, kind of getting away from that term, as I said, the individualized assessment language. So there was quite a worry that many individuals would end up having to, have that choice, either follow your religion or receive a government benefit. And they thought that that's infringing on individuals' rights.
So they passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in 1993. And a few years later, the very same Supreme Court declared that law unconstitutional as it applies to individual states. Talk about that case and why they made that decision.
Sure. That's the City of Bernie case. So RFRA had a very broad application. It applied to all the states and the federal government, and it said basically the attempt was to go back to the pre-Smith jurisprudence of if there's an individual assessment an individual, they lose some type of government benefit or are forced to do something that is not in line with their religious belief. Their religious belief is substantially burdened. Then the government in that case has violated RFRA. The problem that the Supreme Court found with RFRA wasn't really with the substantial burden language itself of the statute, but they said that it exceeded Congress's authority to regulate the states. So as applied to the federal government, RFRA is still alive and well today. But it reached too far in the states because there was no finding by Congress that either implicated the taxing authority of the federal government, the remedial authority of the federal government. So that's why, as applied to the states, it was not viewed as constitutional by the Supreme Court.
Now, that's interesting because was that decided on a 10th Amendment basis, on a 14th Amendment basis? Why was that decision made by the court? Did they base it on another aspect of amendments to the Constitution?
Yes, that was based on the 14th Amendment and the right to regulate the states. It is a fairly complicated decision, and I'm not sure I'm prepared to be into the nuances of it at this time, but the invalidation of RFRA really comes down to Congress. You cannot broadly regulate all state mandates or regulations without a finding that without a finding basically saying that the federal government has authority under either the taxing power or the remedial power to regulate the state.
We're going to come back to RFRA in a little while. But when this decision was made by the Supreme Court that declared RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, unconstitutional as applied to the states, Congress came back and passed the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. That's quite a mouthful. What does that act do?
Yes, so the Religious Land Use Institutionalized Person Act, RLUIPA, I refer to it as RLUIPA. Some people refer to it as RLUIPA. I think either fits just fine. That limited what Congress was trying to regulate. So the language was very similar to RFRA, but instead of applying broadly to all governmental actions by the states, it only applied to regulation or treatment of institutionalized persons and regulation of land use. So what Congress decided to do was, okay, RFRA was too broad. Let's focus on two areas where we have the most concern for the protection of religious rights. And so there's some debate in commentators on the passage of RLUIPA of exactly how substantial the findings were made by proponents of RLUIPA. On one hand, you know, the congressional record says that they've amassed a huge amount of evidence regarding the treatment of institutionalized persons and the burdens on the right to exercise religion while institutionalized, as well as the need for really providing extra protection to religious land uses. The theory being that since they are tax-exempt organizations, often municipalities basically had some sort of prejudice against a non-taxable use of land.
Well, and prejudice in some cases, apparently, according to what I've read about the development of this case. Let's talk about some specific examples in religious land use. How does it work to, let's say, protect a local church or a synagogue or mosque or other religious group from a zoning board decision to deny a permit to build a new building or extend a wing or something of that nature? How does this law come into play in that context?
Well, there are some important things to remember about RLUIPA. And one, basically, the hammer behind the law that, I guess, encourages many municipalities to act more favorably to religious land uses is the fact that a prevailing party, a prevailing plaintiff, can recover their attorney's fees if they win on any of their RLUIPA claims. So to keep that in the back of your mind when we're talking about the law, because that can amount to, you know, millions of dollars, especially if a lawsuit goes on for several years. There are different provisions of RLUIPA. It's really broken into two categories. A plaintiff will prevail if they show that they were substantially burdened by a municipality's denial or a municipality's grant of a permit with conditions that somehow burdens the land use. And substantial burden we could talk about for hours, really, because there's no definition in the law of what a substantial burden actually is. So that has developed over the years and differently depending on what circuit court, what circuit you're in.
Now this would just to interject for Carla for a moment. By the way, we're talking with Carla Chafee. Carla is with Robinson & Cole in Boston, and she is an attorney specializing in these two laws that we're discussing about religion today. To clarify a little bit, this question of substantial burden, that would be a case-by-case basis. Is that fair to say? It depends on the facts of an individual case?
That's very fair to say. These substantial burden cases are extremely fact-dependent, and that's also one of the reasons why this type of litigation, if it moves forward and the case isn't settled early in the conflict, can last for a very long time and end up being very substantial cost for a municipality, because just like any other case, there's facts on each side, and so often it's difficult for a municipality that has no type of discriminatory motive or thinks that they are just enforcing their land use laws to the best of their ability. If there is a claim of substantial burden, it doesn't have to have anything to do with discrimination or religious animus. The plaintiff could still prevail if the action of the municipality somehow inhibits the religious exercise of that plaintiff.
That's pretty broad.
It's very broad. Yes, it is. The substantial burden language has come out of, you know, it was an effort to, say, restore the, you know, pre-employment division Smith case law. But in my opinion, what it really did was highlight an undefined term in case law, and it's exemplified the ability to sue under First Amendment protections, now under the statutory protection, where an individual or a group can recover attorney's fees. So really, you know, there's not much risk for a religious individual to sue a municipality if they're unhappy with the results of the local process.
Has this brought on a lot of cases since 2000?
It has. It's a very robust area, I guess, of litigation. I'll just plug quickly. We have a blog, RLUIPADefense.com, where we track all of these cases that are coming up across the country. So it gives you a good flavor of the types of plaintiffs and the outcomes of some of these cases.
Give us the blog name again.
Sure. It is RLUIPADefense.com.
Okay. Now, you know what? It just crossed my mind, Carla Chafee. One wonders whether Native American peoples, in relation to their sacred lands, could use this particular law to protect parts of their land from things like, oh, I don't know, pipeline?
Well, that is a very good thought, and it's something that, you know, out in the Dakotas has been thought of already. There was a lawsuit that was filed against the federal government, oh, I say maybe 3 weeks ago or so. The status of that is still very new, so I'm not sure what the outcome will be, but it's an interesting case to be watching.
We're going to shift now to talk about the other part of this law, which is the institutionalized persons area. I will tell you that later in this edition, we're going to hear from a former prisoner in New York State prisons, and he thinks the law has made some religious things easier in prisons. But let's start with some definitions. As we think of institutionalized persons as just being prisoners in prisons and jails, but this law goes farther than that, if I'm correct?
That's true. Any institution that receives state or federal funding, and so often areas not where people are receiving treatment, would fall into that category as well as prisons, although by far the vast majority of cases are brought by individuals in prison, often on a pro se basis. Sometimes religious advocacy groups will get involved in funding a complaint as well.
What does the law do?
Well, it gives a cause of action to individuals to say, basically, you, by not letting me, it's usually not letting me have X, not letting me do Y, have imposed a burden on my religion. Common fact patterns that you see often in institutionalized persons' wing of cases is that access to a sweat lodge has been brought by Native American prisoners in several cases. Access to kosher meals has been brought often. There's actually a Supreme Court case that came out fairly recently, Holt v. Hobbs. In that case, the Supreme Court considered whether the prison's policy of requiring inmates to shave was a substantial burden on an inmate who was of the Muslim faith, and having facial hair was part of his religious expression. The prisoner ended up prevailing in that case in court.
So you can wear a beard?
You can wear a beard. So getting into the nuances of the case quite a bit, was what the court did was, there's a multi-step analysis in whether or not RLUIPA was violated. The first question that the court asks is this a substantial burden on religious exercise? They concluded, well, yes, because not carrying facial hair is a violation of religious rights or religious precepts. And then the next step is, well, even if it is substantially burdened, does the government entity have a compelling interest? And is their policy narrowly tailored to further that interest? So you can still burden religion if you have a really, really good reason to. And in this case, the court said, well, you can't really have a compelling interest, which is narrowly tailored, because your interest in public safety or safety in the prison isn't really furthered by requiring people to have, say, a shaved face, since you already make an exception for individuals with skin conditions. And also, you allow people to have hair on their head. So hiding contraband in a beard that, say, is 3 inches long is not very plausible, especially when carried compared to the ability to, say, hide a razor blade in your hair. This, you know, there's the same problem. So why are you targeting, you know, wearing a beard when, if your interest really is in safety of the prison environment?
Under this law, Carla, do prisons have to provide clergy and space to worship?
There does have to be space to worship. And whatever is necessary to accommodate a given religion. Obviously, different religions, you know, are practiced in different ways. But there would be, say, for instance, if someone needs to be led in prayer by clergy, then that has to be made available to the individual prisoners.
And this is at the cost of the state or the municipality or the federal government?
Yes, it is. Actually, that's something that came out of the Holt v. Hobbs case as well. They said, when you look at the question of whether or not their policy is narrowly tailored to that compelling government interest, well, if they could still, when I say they, the government entity, you know, meet their compelling government interest without burdening religion, even if they have to spend some money to do it, you still need to spend that money. You know, obviously, the amount of money, the rationality of or proportionality, that, you know, that's undefined in case law, and that's why we continue to see litigation today. It's not cut and dry. As you said, under substantial burden, everything is very fact-specific.
Okay, let's circle back around to the fact that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act is still in effect for federal issues. This was important in the Hobby Lobby case, was it not?
And yes.
Now, just for our listeners, that's the case, in case you have forgotten, where the family-owned company objected to the requirement in Obamacare that they had to provide insurance for contraceptives to female employees. The Supreme Court ruled that that requirement infringed on a family company's religious beliefs and imposed too heavy a burden on them. So how was RFRA relevant in the Hobby Lobby case?
Well, RFRA was relevant in this case, and it applied because it was a federal mandate. And as we mentioned earlier in the recording, that RFRA, although invalidated as applied to the states, still applies to the federal government. And in this case, it was the federal mandate, as you mentioned, of providing health insurance, which also included certain, there were, I believe, 3 out of 20 types of birth control that were offered that were specifically objected to by the owners of the Hobby Lobby. And so they were, according to the court, forced with this choice between following their religious conscience on one hand and being subject to penalties by the federal government on the other. And so the court came back to the reasoning that you saw in the pre-Smith cases, again, that's not a choice that the federal government should be imposing on individuals.
The idea here is that it is putting the government in the position of deciding for individuals or companies what religion means, in effect?
Well, what religion means, I think I would put it more as in deciding between whether or not you can follow your religion or receive a benefit or / are not penalized by the federal government. And yeah, the underlying policy behind all First Amendment cases and the Constitution itself is really that the government is not here to tell you how to worship or define what your worship is.
Even though the law, according to the Obama administration lawyers, was neutral, that it applied to all employers other than religious organizations directly, like churches and church schools and so forth.
Right. I mean, there are exemptions within Obamacare for religious nonprofits to make an application, and then there are exceptions to the requirements of providing certain types of health insurance. The Hobby Lobby case came up because they're not a nonprofit organization. They're a closely held corporation. And that drifts into a lot of issues regarding who does the First Amendment protect? who are the people behind a corporation? You know, the reasoning of the court could be narrowly interpreted based on the fact that this was a closely held family corporation. How that extends to other types of businesses remains, you know, yet to be seen. And also another very interesting issue that's raised for the land use context, as was mentioned in Justice Ginsburg's dissent to the decision, was if a closely held corporation can exert their rights under RFRA in this circumstance, what prevents them from raising a RLUIPA substantial burden claim in the land use context?
That's interesting. Needless to say, that decision was controversial. And when courts make these decisions, they're in effect, and you said this, you've implied this, Carla, but let me have you expand on it a little bit. In effect, they're deciding which set of rights is the most important to the court on any given day, right? Are the women who want insurance to pay for contraceptives more important, or are the company owners' religious beliefs more important?
I think the way that you phrased the question would probably be objected to by the justices in the majority opinion on Hobby Lobby. I do think that is the way what Justice Sotomayor and Justice Ginsburg would view the question. In this case, yes, and actually in a specific occurrence in the Holt v. Haas case that I mentioned earlier, one of the reasons that the more liberal justices, as you may say, of the Supreme Court agreed with the decision in Holt v. Haas was because there was not a burden placed on other individuals' rights, i.e. the right of women to contraceptives. It's interesting how certain wings of the court view rights under the First Amendment compared to, say, maybe the unenumerated rights that a woman has to her own reproductive health.
Well, it's obviously very, very fascinating and difficult decisions. You're weighing one set of individuals' rights against another's, et cetera. I would like to ask you one more question, if I may. And again, we're talking with Carla Chafee of Robinson & Cole in Boston. This question has to do with a reality that a number of states have passed their own religious freedom restoration acts in the last several years. Are you aware of what the impact of these new laws has been in the various states?
Very often when there is a claim under RLUIPA, it's married with, there's an additional claim under the State Religious Freedom Act. In some states, protections are broader than they are under RLUIPA or RFRA. So you'll see, for instance, what comes to mind immediately are, you know, the bakery cases where a small business denies the right of an individual to, you know, order something from their store. They claim that they're burdened by being required to, you know, serve all individuals that come into their bakery. Those claims have been made under state religious freedom acts. In that specific instance, they didn't get very far because that would be discriminating against individuals based on who they are and their own beliefs. But that's just another instance of fact patterns where these types of protections come up often.
Well, we're going to have to end at this point today, Carla, but this really is a complex and fascinating part of American law. My sense is that many of us don't understand it very well.
It is a very complex area of the law in that it's still evolving. And also, it's not only complex, but it's very emotionally charged because whenever you're talking about individual rights and then the right to believe, you know, what you have personal faith in, it's often, unfortunately, ripe for conflict because, especially in the land use context, you know, it places individuals' religious beliefs against, you know, maybe a community's understanding of how they want to plan for their future. So I don't think these cases are going away anytime soon.
Thank you very much for talking with us today. I do appreciate it.
Sure, thank you.
Our focus in this edition is religious freedom in prisons, the First Amendment, and the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act is designed in part to protect the rights of prisoners to practice elements of their faith while in prison. For instance, the law has been interpreted by the courts to permit Muslim prisoners to have short beards to respect their beliefs. What is the status of religious freedom in prisons now? My guest is Mujahid Farid. He is the lead organizer for the Release Aging People in Prison campaign, or RAP, which is designed to impact policy accelerating the release rate of elderly people in New York State prisons. Farid was himself confined for 33 years in New York State and released in 2011. While confined, Farid earned 4 college degrees, including 2 masters. And during his time, Farid litigated many cases which affected changes in conditions of confinement. He taught himself the law and acted as his own attorney in several cases. He won most of them. Free speech in prison has been one focus of his work. Today, we are going to concentrate specifically on the issues of religious freedom. Farid, welcome to our discussion.
Thank you for having me present my viewpoints on this issue.
I do appreciate it. Let me have you give us an overview, first of all, on how you think prisoners' faith is actually respected in prisons.
First of all, let me say that I actually did very little litigation on religious freedoms while I was confined for 33 years. What I did litigate quite a bit on was First Amendment issues. I was aware of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act when it came out, and I still didn't use it much. I still relied mainly on the First Amendment during the course of my litigations, which were mainly speech, as you mentioned, issues of free speech. And then I recall that sometime in the late 90s, I think the Religious Freedom Restoration Act was challenged and ruled unconstitutional as applied to the states. And shortly thereafter, the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Person Act was pretty much enacted. And I never got a chance to use it.
Let's talk about what your experience is, just mm-hmm. as somebody who has been in the prisons for such an extended mm-hmm. time. Let's talk about some specifics. For instance, mm-hmm. I mentioned beards. There's a Supreme yes. Court case that deals with this. And we know several religions, the Muslims and the Sikhs, believe mm-hmm. that hair and beards are important to their faith. Mm-hmm. What was your experience with issues like beards in the New York State prisons?
I think that most of those issues have been well established for the last 30 to 40 years in New York prisons. So there was not that much of a problem with it. I think that the one issue with respect to religion as applied to Muslims that came up on occasion was the wearing of kufis and what was considered an acceptable kufi. And a kufi is the caps that some Muslims wear on their heads.
And what that concerned was there were certain kinds of kufis that were acceptable to the authorities and others that were not?
Absolutely.
What about food, Farid? Jews keep kosher, Muslims keep halal. Are these kinds of foods available in prisons generally?
No. Halal foods, Muslims have, as I recall, fought for quite a while and somehow didn't get actually halal meals instituted in the facilities. And I think one of the reasons for that was because some of the Muslim chaplains, I call them, people who were working for Department of Corrections and were of the Muslim faith, came to many of those litigation hearings and testified that it wasn't really necessary for the establishment of halal meals, that some of the foods that were being served were acceptable.
Now, kosher food is a different issue, as I understand it. Kosher food is available?
Yeah, kosher food is available in almost all of the facilities.
What about religious services, Farid? Are there regular chances for prisoners of various faiths to worship in prisons? Are clergy available?
Yes, they. What the New York State started doing, I would say, in the early 80s, they started hiring Muslim chaplains. we resisted them calling them imams because that presented a problem within the faith of many Muslims. Many believers would object that the state couldn't appoint an imam over a Muslim community. So they actually named them chaplains.
The name was important because that would have been the state assuming a religious establishment role. Is that what I'm understanding?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right.
What about the treatment of minority religions generally in prisons? We have a lot of faiths in the United States.
That's where there's a lot of problems, I believe, up until today. Many of the minority religions that are on the margins, they suffer a lot of problems trying to get their rights respected in many of the prisons.
Can you give me some examples?
I would say, although they have made some headways, the Rastafarians.
The Rastafarians are not able to generally worship, and do you know why?
Because in many facilities, they are not. I don't think they're that organized in many facilities to be able to press the issue of respecting their religion. And that may be one of the major reasons, the fact that in any given facility, they may not be well organized in order to issue demands for religious freedoms.
One of the things that is true of religious law generally is that institutions have to make what are called reasonable accommodations.
Yes.
How do you, from your perspective, define reasonable, Fareed?
Well, my experience, I think a reasonable accommodation basically is an accommodation that doesn't place too much burden on the administrators of the prison. And I think it's an interpretation of the court, what is too much of a burden.
And what are some of the parameters of that? How do you think in terms of reasonable? Can you give me an example of what would be unreasonable?
I don't think that the institutions or the policymakers can claim that because of some additional expense that is unreasonable. Even if it incurs additional expense, they would have to provide those accommodations.
So that would be things like providing clergy and space to worship?
Yes.
Well, listen, I really do appreciate you taking some time to talk with us on this. Your experience is extensive, and I wish you good luck, sir.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you. Religion and the Constitution is meant to offer a brief history of freedom of religion in the United States. It's intended to help you interpret what freedom of religion means in everyday life. These conversations with the legal experts and the narration will not answer every question about what the courts have said about religious freedom. They do attempt to give you a basic understanding of the law. Nothing here should be taken as legal advice. If you have a problem concerning religious freedom, you should contact qualified legal assistance. Thanks to Josh LaBella for helping with the research and street interviews. And thanks to Tedra Schneider for creating the theme music. And thank you for listening. I'm Jerry Dunkley.